Wilson used starvation to advance his agenda. The Versailles Treaty included the shame paragraphs, which was the main cause of the German representatives for walking out of the meetings. Wilson told the Germans that the time for discussion is past. They had less than 24 hours to sign or be invaded by 30 divisions backed by aircraft and a renewed blockade that would cut off every scrap of food from the outside world. This threat of state terrorism had its intended effect, and the Germans acquiesced. Journalist Oswald Garrison Villard said that the godly Presbyterian from the White House could not be induced to make a public stand against this indefensible cruelty to noncombatants. The screw of starvation was kept turned on in order to compel the vanquished to sign whatever treaty might be drafted. King George V said the U.S. president was an odious man. Another European leader remarked that Wilson considered himself to be the first man in two millennia who knows anything about peace. Wilson said, "It is wonderful to be president." When they were cutting up Germany and parceling out Europe to all these nations that claimed a right to a certain part of the European territory, the Jews said, "How about Palestine for us?" And they produced, for the first time, to the knowledge of the Germans, the Balfour Declaration. The British cabinet, over the signature of Foreign Secretary Arthur Balfour, issued a statement that looms large in retrospect, but seemed a minor matter in most of the world at that time. The Balfour Declaration was embodied in a letter that the Foreign Secretary wrote to Lord Rothschild, who was the unofficial leader of the Jewish community in England. The letter said that His Majesty's government views with favor the establishment in Palestine of a national home for the Jewish people and will issue their best endeavors to facilitate the achievement of this object, it being clearly understood that nothing shall be done which may prejudice civil and religious rights of existing non-Jewish communities in Palestine or the rights and political status enjoyed by Jews in any other country. This epochal document was created by a complex interplay between the dynamics of the war and the personal diplomacy by Jews who had become converts to Zionism. Zionism is a vision of a regained Jewish homeland articulated by the late 19th century poet and playwright Theodore Herzl. In England, one of Zionism's leading exponents was the gifted chemist James Weizmann, who had intermittently conferred with Balfour and Lloyd George during the preceding decade. Both of these powerful politicians developed an attachment to the idea, thanks to their nonconformist religious past. So the Germans for the first time realized, oh, that was the game. That's why the United States came into the war. And the Germans realized they were defeated. They suffered this terrific reparation that was slapped onto them because the Zionists wanted Palestine and they were determined to get it at any cost. Up to that time, the Jews had never been better off in any country in the world than they had been in Germany. They had Mr. Rathenauer there, who was maybe 100 times as important in industry and finance as was Bernard Baruch in this country. You also had Mr. Balin, who owned the two big steamship lines, the North German Lloyds and the Hamburg American lines. You had Mr. Bleichroeder, who was the banker for the Hezolan family. You also had the Warburgs, who were the biggest merchant bankers in the world. The Jews were doing very well in Germany, no question about that. And now the Germans felt, well, that was quite a sellout. And yes, the Germans resented what they believed the Jews had done to them. The Jews themselves admitted the feeling against the Jews in Germany was due to the fact that the Germans realized that this great defeat was brought about by the Jews' intercession and bringing the United States into the war against the Germans. It wasn't that the Germans in 1919 discovered that a glass of Jewish blood tasted better than Coca-Cola or German beer. There was no religious feeling. There was no sentiment against those people merely on account of their religious beliefs. It was all political. It was all economic. It was anything but religious. Back in this country, Paul Warburg resigned from the Federal Reserve in May of 1918 and returned to his $500,000-a-year job at Kuhn Lieb Company, but he continued to determine the policy of the Federal Reserve System as president of the Federal Advisory Council and as chairman of the Executive Committee of the American Acceptance Council. From 1921 to 1929, Paul Warburg organized three of the greatest trusts in the United States: the Agfa Asco Film Corporation, with headquarters in Belgium; the I.G. Farben Corporation, whose American branch Warburg set up as I.G. Chemical Corporation; the Westinghouse Corporation; and the International Acceptance Bank, the largest acceptance bank in the world. The International Acceptance Bank handled trade acceptances. Trade acceptances are drafts drawn by the seller of goods on the producer of goods with a time of expiration stamped upon it. Before 1915, the use of trade acceptances, which is money for international trade, was practically unheard of. With the passage of the Federal Reserve Act, the use of these acceptances became widely used by commerce, industry, and bankers. The men who set up the Federal Reserve also set up the use of acceptances and profited by them. The leader of these men was Paul Warburg. The Banking Act of 1864 did not allow banks to loan their credit, and banks could not create money in any large amount. The Banking Act of 1864 regulated our banking system until November 16, 1914, when it was replaced by the Federal Reserve System. Before trade acceptances were used, business transactions in this country were made on the open book system. The open book system was usually held by the seller and allowed a discount for cash. These are single-name commercial papers and bear only the name of the debtor. It also allowed easier terms of payment with liberal extensions on the debt. The trade acceptance is a short-term credit with the time date stamped on it, and it is out of the seller's hands and into the hands of a bank, usually an acceptance bank, which does not allow any extension of time. It greatly facilitated the domination and swallowing up of small businesses into huge trust, which accumulated into the crash of 1929. Trade acceptances were used during the Civil War, but fell out of favor because of the exigencies of trade and destroyed the acceptance as a trade medium. The wholesale market used the trade acceptances, which supplied short-term assured credit to carry goods in process of production, storage, transit, and marketing. They facilitated domestic and foreign commerce. Propaganda was used to sell this idea by showing trade acceptances to be progressive and would help American import-export trade. The National City Bank accepted the first-time draft drawn on a national bank under provisions of the Federal Reserve Act of 1913. After this, the use of the open book system went into decline and all but finally shut down. With the Federal Reserve System and the use of trade acceptances, Paul Warburg and his group got complete control of the nation's credit. The First World War saw a huge increase in the use of trade acceptances, and it continued after the war's end and reached its peak in November 1929. Soon after the First World War ended, the headquarters of the acceptance market was moved from London to New York. It was this transference which caused Thomas Lamont to state in a speech before the Academy of Political Science in 1917, he said that the dollar, not the pound, is now the basis for international exchange. Daddy Warbucks, a character in the old comic strip, Little Orphan Annie, and in the musical stage and screenplay Annie, is a takeoff of Paul Warburg. Daddy Warbucks has almost magical powers that can accomplish anything by the power of his limitless wealth. In the early 1920s, the Federal Reserve System played the decisive role in the re-entry of Russia into the international finance structure. The Federal Reserve System began purchasing Russian gold in 1920. The Russian currency was accepted on the exchanges. An English monthly magazine named Fourth Nightly of July 1922 says, "During the past year, practically every single capitalistic institution has been restored. This is true of the state bank, private banking, the stock exchange, the right to possess money to unlimited amount, the right of inheritance, the bill of exchange system, and other institutions and practices involved in the conduct of private industry and trade. A great part of the former nationalized industry are now found in semi-independent trust. As economic pressure produced the astronomical dimension system of currency, it can never destroy it. Taken alone, the system is self-contained, logically perfected, even intelligent, and it can perish only through collapse or destruction of the political edifice which it decorates. Since 1921, the daily life of the Soviet citizen is no different from that of the American system, and the Soviet system of government is more economical." Well, that's what the magazine Fourth Nightly said about the new Russian social structure. You and I both know that that is just a lot of Baja humor. This organization of powerful trust in Russia, under the guise of communism, made possible the receipt of large amounts of financial and technical help from the United States Trust. During the Russian Revolution, the opponent of the Red Army was the White Armies led by Admiral Kolchak. United States troops were sent to Siberia in order to have a pretext for printing Kolchak rubles. In 1920, the bankers were manipulating on the London Exchange the old Tsarist rubles, the Kerensky rubles, and the Kolchak rubles, the values of all three fluctuating according to the movements of the Allied troops aiding Kolchak. This is how the speculators make their money, not with stability, but with chaos. In this example, it was the fluctuations of the value of the three rubles where the speculators made their money. During the fighting, Kolchak had seized a large amount of gold. After his defeat, a trainload of this gold disappeared into Siberia. At a Senate hearing held in 1921, it was brought out that gold was coming into the New York banks from Russia by way of Europe. W.P.G. Harding, who was governor of the Federal Reserve at that time, testified that it was none of the Federal Reserve's business to know where the gold came from. Now, just a little review here. At the beginning of these programs, I endeavored to explain how the goldsmiths used gold as their origin for creating money, and used the example of 1 unit of gold being the basis for creating 10 units of paper money. If the entire world was on the gold standard, and you could control the amount of gold in the world, a small group of people could control the economy of every nation on the gold standard, which would, in effect, be the control of the entire world. I'm reminding you of this because during the decades of the 20s, the Federal Reserve and the Bank of England and other central banks wanted the world to get back on the gold standard. Professor Gustav Kassel wrote in 1928 that the American dollar, not the gold standard, is the world's monetary standard. Paul Enzig, who was an editorial writer for the London Economist, said in 1931 that almost immediately after World War I, a close cooperation was established between the Bank of England and the Federal Reserve authorities, and more especially with the Federal Reserve Bank of New York. There has been close cooperation in the fixing of discount rates between London and New York. When discount rates are high, gold will be attracted to the country. When discount rates are low, gold will have a tendency to leave the country. This was a fact when we were still on the gold standard. The American Federal Reserve Board has the power to determine the purchasing power of the dollar by making changes in the rate of discount, and thus controls the monetary standard of the world. On several occasions, the discount rate policy of the Federal Reserve Bank of New York was guided by a desire to help the Bank of England. This cooperation was largely due to the cordial relationship between Mr. Benjamin Strong and Mr. Montague Norman. Lord Montague Norman is the only man in history who had both his maternal grandfather and his paternal grandfather serve as governors of the Bank of England. Since the founding of the Bank of England in 1694, the terms of the governors of that bank had normally been 2 years, sometimes three or maybe four, if a crisis was threatening or occurring. But Montague Norman was the governor of the Bank of England for 24 consecutive years. Like his father, as a young man he came to New York to work for Brown Brothers in 1894, where he was befriended by the Delano family and by James Marco of Brown Brothers. In 1912, he had a nervous breakdown and went to Switzerland to be treated by Jung, as was fashionable among the powerful group which he represented. Montague Norman and Benjamin Strong became extremely close friends, and Norman was Strong's alter ego. They spent many of their vacations together at Bal Harbour in the south of France. According to Carol Quigley, Norman had a mental outlook bordering on paranoia. He was a strong-willed, tireless, and ruthless man. When he rebuilt the Bank of England, he considered his gold reserves sacred. He had the gold buried below the level of underground waters, which could be released to cover them by pressing a button on the governor's desk. It was Norman and Strong who, in the 1920s, were determined to force all the major countries of the world to go on the gold standard and to operate it through central banks free from all political control, with all questions of international finance to be settled by agreements by such central banks without interference from governments. The apex of the system was to be the Bank for International Settlements in Basel, Switzerland, which is a private bank owned and controlled by the world's central banks, which were themselves private corporations. The goal was to create a world system of financial control in private hands, able to dominate the political system of each country and economy of the world as a whole. It must not be felt, however, that these heads of the world's chief central banks were themselves substantive owners in world finance. They were not. Rather, they were the technicians and agents of the dominant investment beings of their own countries who had raised them up and were perfectly capable of throwing them down. The substantive financial powers of the world were in the hands of these investment bankers, also called international or merchant bankers, and they remained largely behind the scenes in their own unincorporated private banks. These formed a system of international cooperation and national dominance which was more private, more powerful, and more secret than that of their agents in central banks. Professor Quigley, speaking of the real power of the central bank, said that these men maintained their power even though the banks themselves may have become theoretically socialized. The League of Nations was organized for the purpose of getting all nations back on the gold standard, which it had been on up until 1914 and the outbreak of the First World War. But the League of Nations was not successful in this endeavor. There had been a verbal agreement and understanding between Benjamin Strong and Montague Norman that a $200 million gold loan on credit was to be extended to Great Britain over a two-year period. The purpose of the loan was to help England get back on the gold standard, and the loan was to be met by investment of Federal Reserve funds in bills of exchange and foreign securities. There was also a gold loan of $100 million from J.P. Morgan & Company. Winston Churchill, the British governor of the Exchequer, complained later that the cost to the British government on this loan was $1,125,000 the first year. Ironically, this sum represented the exact profit to J.P. Morgan Company at that time. In May 1925, the British Parliament passed the Gold Standard Act, putting Great Britain back on the gold standard. Then a secret meeting took place in the United States with heads of the European Central Banks and Strong, who was the governor of the Federal Reserve Bank of New York. This meeting was held to discuss the best way of getting $500 million of gold held in the United States back to Europe to force European nations back on the gold standard. They could do this, they said, by lowering the Federal Reserve's discount rate. Gold would then leave the country, but more money would be put into circulation for speculation in the stock market by the common American on the street. Later, at a Senate investigating committee, there was a question asked, who in the world called this meeting? Governor Miller thought the meeting was called by the Bank of France, but Governor Young said that the meeting was called by the League of Nations. The increase in the money supply did cause a bull market in stocks. Stocks were bought on margin with sometimes as little as 10% down. When the stocks were sold at an increase, the balance was paid and the profit pocketed or reinvested. This speculation in the stock market caused the inflation of the 1920s. A Senate investigating committee was formed to investigate how this was done. Carter Glass said that it was clear that the Federal Reserve Board provided a terrific credit expansion by their open market transactions. Governor Adolph C. Miller said that if we had not had the Federal Reserve System, he didn't think we would have had the speculative situation we had to begin with. Inflation during this period was of a speculative nature only. It was a trader-made situation. Prices of commodities remained fairly low, while the overpricing of securities was incredible. People didn't buy securities to earn a return on dividends. They hoped to hold them a while and sell them at a profit. In August 1929, the Federal Reserve Board raised the discount rate to 6%. The next month, the Bank of England raised its rate from 5.5% to 6.5%. People complained that the money rates were too high, but President Calvin Coolidge, the Secretary of the Treasury, and the Chairman of the Board of Governors of the Federal Reserve issued a statement that said that the loans were not too high and the condition of the stock market was sound. The Literary Digest on August 4, 1928, when writing about the Federal Reserve Board raising the rate to 5% in the presidential year, said that this reverses the political desirable cheap money policy of 1927 and gives smooth conditions to the stock market. But that statement was attacked by the People's Lobby in Washington, D.C., which said that this increase at a time when farmers needed cheap money to finance the harvesting of their crops was a direct blow to the farmers who had begun to get back on their feet after the agricultural depression of 1920 and 1921. This made the cost of money too dear, and people could not meet their obligations to pay their margins on their stocks. This resulted in a lowering of prices, or, better put, a recession. Again, Professor Gustav Cassell remarked, "The downward movement of prices has not been a spontaneous result of forces beyond our control. It is the result of a policy deliberately framed to bring down prices and give a higher value to the monetary unit. As you remember, the goldsmiths of the Middle Ages, when they lost one unit of gold, the money supply had to decrease by the unit of 10 because gold was the goldsmith's reserves for creating money. The loss of gold from the Federal Reserve had the same effect on our money supply. The movement of that gold out of the United States caused the deflation of the stock boom, the end of the business prosperity of the 1920s, and the Great Depression of 1929 to 1931. The bankers knew what would happen when that $500 million worth of gold went to Europe. Maybe the financiers used the depression as a punishment for the people of the United States not joining the League of Nations. In 1925, the Banker's Magazine gleefully reported that the outstanding event of the past half year in the banking world was the restoration of the gold standard. The world's jubilation was followed by Black Tuesday on October 29, 1929, the day of the great stock market crash. John Kenneth Galbraith tells us that on Black Tuesday, Bernard Baruch took Winston Churchill into the visitor's booth of the stock exchange so Churchill could see the transactions being made and the power that the bankers had. Reginald McKenna, the former English Chancellor of the Exchequer, said that the gold standard can be and is usefully managed and controlled for the benefit of a small group of traders. Sorry to say it, but our time is up for today. The Great Depression and problems of the 1930s will be on our next topic. Hope you can join us then. But for now, I've got to say so long.